Okay, let's jump in, and I'll navigate around the screen. Might make try to make it a bit bigger as we go through. So where we left off last week was we read through the story in Perek Gimel in Daniel, which is the story of Nebuchadnezzar and his great big golden statue, calling all the peoples together to bow down to this statue made out of pure gold. The simple pshat of the story is a direct response to the dream that he has and the vision of the large statue that's made up of multiple parts, namely, gold and bronze and copper silver and iron, etc. And of course, he wants to, his desire is to respond to that dream by making the equivalent statue 60 amot high and making that statue out of pure gold. And that's in his way of saying, okay, bring all the nations of the world together and, or within his kingdom, and acknowledge his authority and power by bringing this statue and having them all bow down and acknowledge his greatness and his deed and his gods, etc. And in so doing, kind of counter the challenges that the original dream would create. That by in itself is a relatively straightforward part of the story. And then, of course, Hanani, Mishael, and Azariah, who refused to bow down and thereby throw a monkey wrench into his great plan. If the Jews won't bow down to him and acknowledge his or to his statue or to his gold image, whatever it is that he's built, if the Jews won't bow down, then essentially what has he accomplished? Because the whole point of the dream was that eventually the nation that will reassert itself on the stage of history are the Jews in the context of that last kingdom. That more or less is the story. And he throws them into the fiery furnace, and there's a great miracle, and the Malach saves them. And then Daniel and Nebuchadnezzar is moved to respond to that by publicly acknowledging the God of Israel. More or less, that's where the story itself, just from the text perspective of chapter three. What we then did with that was we said, wait a second, fiery furnace, Kivshan Aish, throw Jew thrown into the furnace for refusing to bow down. That sounds very much like the Medrash about Avraham. And in fact, what we had suggested was that Chazal often did this, where they would take stories from Tanakh and build a connection to other stories by almost recreating the biblical story in the context of this other event or personality or story or context. And so we looked at various examples of that, and it comes back to the question of what connections were Chazal trying to highlight in the parallel between the story of Abraham and his experience with the region of Mesopotamia where he was functioning, to the story of Hanani, Mishael, and Azariah in Babel under Nebuchadnezzar. And that's where more or less we left off. What Chazal did was they said, okay, wait a second. You have this giant statue made of gold, and you have Nebuchadnezzar and his arrogance on the one hand, and you have Hanani, Mishael, and Azariah and their faith on the other. And you have Abraham and his faith against the symbol of the arrogance of and power of that era, which is in the language of Chazal, Nimrod. And what I want to do today is kind of work through that link between Nebuchadnezzar and Nimrod to try to better understand what Chazal are trying to reflect in the story. And ultimately, where that's going to take us is to the two great structures that symbolize the arrogance and power of the two great leaders of the day, Nebuchadnezzar on the one hand and his statue of gold, and Nimrod on the other, who is the leader of the area of Babel in the days of Abraham, and Nimrod's story, which we will see exactly what that refers to, but already I think I kind of led us into the punchline of that at the end of the shiur last week, where there is a link between Nimrod and the tower above all. And so ultimately, where our story today takes us is to the parallel between the tower of Babel and its symbolism and the statue of Nebuchadnezzar and its symbolism. How that relates to Abraham, that's also part of our story for today. So that's kind of the map of where we're going, and hopefully we'll get through all of it. And we're going to jump right into this Gemara in Chagiga. Well, I think I shared with you at the end of the shiur last week where Abraham is in the furnace, or is going being thrown into the furnace, and there's a conversation between God in the Medrash, between God and the Malach Gavriel. And Malach Gavriel says he wants to save Abraham, and God says to him, no, God is going to save Abraham, but the Malach Gavriel is destined to save the descendants of, or another, descendants of Abraham. And that's, of course, a reference to the story of Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah. Gavriel is also a link to our story because Gavriel as a Malach is only mentioned once, or twice, but in the same book, one other book in Tanakh and by name, and that is, of course, in Sefer Daniel. Daniel has many conversations with the angel Gavriel at the end of the book. So you have this direct link, again, in the Medrash between these two stories, and Chazal trying to weave their way through multiple points of connection between these two great moments in history. And one of them is in this Gemara in Chagiga. And that's our starting point. Gemara says the following. If you can't see it, I'm going to make it a little bit bigger for you. Hopefully that'll work. Tanya Amar of Yochanan ben Zak Amar of Yochanan ben Zakkai. Ma tshuva hashivatu bat hashivatu? What response did the divine voice provide bat kol le'oto rasha, to that wicked one, and in this case referring to Nebuchadnezzar? Bisha'a she'amar, when Nebuchadnezzar said, e'ele al bamatei av edamele elyon, I will ascend above the clouds, I will be like the Most High. What was God's response to the arrogance of Nebuchadnezzar when in his proclamation that he will rise above the clouds and be equal to the one on high? And in the back of our minds, we should be asking ourselves, where did Chazal see this verse referring to a statement of Nebuchadnezzar? That's the question we're going to come to. But the answer the Gemara gives is Yetzta batko ve'amra lo. What was the response? The heavenly voice came out and said to Nebuchadnezzar, Rasha ben Rasha, ben bino shel Nimrod harasha, wicked son of wicked, grandson of Nimrod the wicked, shehimrid kol ha'olam kulo la'bemalchuto, Nimrod who caused all of the world to rebel against him in the days of his reign. So in this passage, there are two things that we need to be, that will start our journey. Number one, this verse, as it refers to Nebuchadnezzar, the connection between Nebuchadnezzar and Nimrod, Chazal are connecting explicitly and saying that Nimrod, that Nebuchadnezzar in some way is kind of a great descendant of Nimrod. We'll see, that's not a biological descendant, but a conceptual, right, model. And the response of to Nimrod is that he is that to Nebuchadnezzar is that he is essentially following the path set before him in the wickedness of and the arrogance of Nimrod. Tosfot there on that Gemara makes this observation, and he says, "Lav dafka sharei Kush yolad Nimrod, v'lo matzinu otor hasham mizera Kush." We're not talking about a biological descendant of Nimrod. Nimrod comes from the nation of Kush. And we'll see where that's from. And Nebuchadnezzar is certainly not from that region. But Ela al shem ma'asav shemalach sham shegamhu b'shinar. Nebuchadnezzar is associated with Nimrod because Eretz Shinar, which is where Nimrod was the king, and I'll show you that verse in a second, right? Eretz Shinar is in fact Bavel. And so the region in which you have this great power in Sefer Bereishit, Nimrod, and in Sefer Daniel, and in Tanakh as a whole, Nebuchadnezzar, is in fact the same region, the same area of Bavel. The Marshal in the Chidushei Agadot says something similar. He just makes it a little bit more explicit in terms of the context. Nimrod harasha shemido olam kulo, kama dichtiv beperiketz in ma'avin. This is a Gemara. Amraphel shmo v'nikra shmo Nimrod. The name, says Chazal, was Amraphel, which is another personality in Bereshit. Why is he called Nimrod? Because he caused all of the world to rebel. Where did he cause all the world to rebel? Watch carefully. Hainu b'dor ha'palaga. In reference to the generation of the dispersion, which is the Chazal's way of describing the Tower of Babel. So the tower, the Migdal Bavel that they built, Chazal saw as the architecture and the plan of Nimrod. Now, Nimrod is not explicitly mentioned in the story of Migdal Bavel, but the link between Nimrod and the tower is very important for us. We'll see it as it plays out. As Rashi explains in Chumash, Nebuchadnezzar is not literally his son, as Tosfos explains, but rather al shem shezeh Nebuchadnezzar, amar elah b'motei av, Nebuchadnezzar's proclamation that I will rise to the clouds and be greater than the one on high, that arrogance against God, that is exactly what is attributed to the story of the Tower of Babel. Nimrod shehimid b'malchuto et dor ha'palaga, amar gam kein la'alot la'shamayim. Nimrod also wanted to go up into the heavens. Now, of course, the reference to going up into the heavens is a reference both to the Tower of Babel and Nebuchadnezzar's great statue of gold that reaches up to the heavens from the perspective of the great height of 60 amot. That was the part, the description of the building of the tower with its head in the sky. We'll see that Gemara in a moment. So where is this verse? So I understand Nimrod, king of Shinar, king of Babel, tower of Babel was certainly a proclamation of arrogance. That I understand. But this verse is in Yeshayahu. How does the verse in Yeshayahu link us to Nebuchadnezzar? So that's the story in Yeshayahu Perek Yudalet. I gave you the text here in Yeshayahu Perek Yudalet. Sometimes easier to see it in the full context of a source page, but the actual website. So I'm going to take us back to this website, which I've used often, which is Yeshayahu Perek Yudalet, and let's take a look at it in the context of the psukim here. So the context of this nevuah begins with the nevuah about Israel returning home, a redemptive moment for Israel. And in that context, Pasuk Dalet begins, "V'nesata hamashal hazeh al melech Bavel." Begin this parable or this statement against the king of Babel. And the king of Babel, of course, is Nebuchadnezzar. So Yeshayahu, in the very early stages, is kind of foreseeing the role that Babel will play, or Babel is already rising up as a power parallel to Assyria. Yeshayahu is seeing that rise, but also seeing the arrogance. This is well before Nebuchadnezzar has become the king of an empire. This is well before the Battle of Carchemish. Yeshayahu sees Nebuchadnezzar and sees the rise of the power of Babel, and he sees the arrogance that will be the trademark of Nebuchadnezzar. V'amarta ech shavta noges shavta madeva. How is the oppressor ceased? The golden city ended, ceased. Madeva is a word which is somewhat debated, whether it comes from the word dahav or zahav, as Rashi explains, or it means more in the context of some sort of oppression. But in the context, but if I translate it from the word gold, the notion of to describe Babel as the golden city, you already are hearing a foreshadowing of the gold that is symbolizing Nebuchadnezzar's kingdom. So that in terms of the statue and the dream that Nebuchadnezzar eventually has. Shavar Hashem Mater Reshaim Shevet Moshnim. God has broken the staff of the wicked, the scepter of the rulers. Smote peoples in wrath with an incessant stroke. Makei Amim Be'evar Makat Bilti Sara. Sort of God's, at a time when God, of redemption, God's anger will break the arrogance of the nations of the world. That's the beginning of this story. I'm going to jump for a moment to Pasuk Aleph. Hurad Sheol Geonecha. Your arrogance will be brought down into the grave. Hemyat Nivalecha Tachtecha. The noise of your nivalim, right, of your carcass underneath you. Yitzar imal mechasecha toliya. You will be covered in worms, right, describing him in the grave. Now, it's always a classic genre of the Nevi'im to say to a human being, if you want to claim that you are a god, that you are a deity, that you are more powerful than God, to describe him as mortal, because ultimately nothing speaks to them to the contrast between God and man more than mortality. Ech nafalta mishamayim, how have you fallen from heaven? Elel ben shachar, day star, nigda'ata la'aretz, been cast down into the ground, cholesh al goyim, cast lots over the nations. V'ata amarta bilbavcha, you in your heart said, hashamayim e'ele, mima'al l'kochve el, I will ascend to the heavens above the stars. Arim kis'i, v'eshev behar mo'ed b'yarkatei tzafon, I will exalt my throne and I will sit upon the throne, in place of meeting in the northern throne, meaning from my throne in the north, I will sit in the throne that will reach even above the heavens. I will ascend over the clouds. I will be like the Most High, says Yishayahu to the king of Babel. Ach el sheol turad. No, you shall be brought down into the grave, to the depths of the pit. In other words, the response to the arrogance of the king of Babel in this context of this Nebuah, who claims that he will rise above the throne of the heavens, is to say to him, to remind him that all human beings are mortal, and no one can say that ultimately that mortality is the douse of reality upon that, against that arrogance. That's the context of this nevuah. And so clearly what Chazal are hearing in this arrogance is exactly what we typically interpret as the story of the Tower of Babel. We all know the classic interpretation of the Tower of Babel is they wanted to build this tower to throw God out of the heavens. That's how we typically explain it. And we're going to see that that's a little bit more complex than just that explanation, but that's how Rashi certainly understood it. That's how at least one of the opinions in the Gemara understood it. And here Chazal is saying, well, that's exactly what Yeshayahu claimed was attributed to the king of Babel. So here's the link. Here's the king of Babel saying, literally, I will build my throne in the heavens and I will throw God. I will sit on the throne of the Most High. And God says to him, try doing that from the grave. And that's exactly the response that we have in the story of the Tower of Babel. So it's a fascinating link between these two moments. It's almost like I hear it in Nebuchadnezzar, I see it in Yeshayahu's Nebuah. How do we get to this meaning of the Tower of Babel? That's a story we'll need to explore. And in fact, the story begins with just a little background. Who is Nimrod? And if we're talking about Nebuchadnezzar and the arrogance, I understand. Where is Nimrod and this tower in all of this? So we need to go back to Sefer Bereishit. We need to start with the story of Nimrod. Who is Nimrod? So just basic Sefer Bereishit. Kush yoladet Nimrod, hu hechel liyot gibor ba'aretz. In early generations, Nimrod, born from Kush, begins to be a warrior in the land. That role that Nimrod is as a gibor, as gibor baretz, as a warrior, hold in your thoughts, we're going to come to in a few moments. Hu haya gibor tzayid lifnei Hashem. He was, here we typically translate tzayid as a hunter, but not in the context of a hunter of animals. That's too simple. Gibor tzayid is a warrior, a hunter warrior. Al ken yamar kin Nimrod gibor tzayid lifnei Hashem. A warrior needs a kingdom, needs a place to expand his war conquests. ותהי ראשית ממלכתו בבל. וערך ועקד וקלנה בארץ שנער. And so the text tells me very clearly that Nimrod's world, Nimrod was Rishit Mamlachto, when Nimrod was a king, Nimrod was a warrior king, Nimrod conquers. And the first place of his conquest is the area of Shinar and the kingdom of Babel. And of course, Babel is immediately a reference to the tower, because the whole region is called Babel because of the story of the tower. So suddenly we're linking geography and themes, arrogance, right? Warrior, Nebuchadnezzar, conquest, Nimrod, conquest, warrior, arrogance, Babel, tower, and great statues. All the themes that come back together. And so this is where we need to kind of sort out exactly what's going on. Rashi uses this as an opportunity again to reflect back from that Gemara in Chagiga, that liot gibor, the sense of being a warrior, is lehamrid kol ha'olam al HaKadosh Baruch Hu ba'atzat dor ha'palaga. That warring sense of conquest is to cause the world to rebel against God in the tower, in the generation of the dispersion, referring to the tower. And again, all of these themes come back together. So where I really want to take us is into the story of the Tower of Babel. What really was this tower? What does it represent? What does it mean? What happened? We often read the story and we kind of don't sufficiently recognize the significance of this little episode at the end of Parshat Noach and the ramifications it has, not only in terms of Babel, but in terms of all of biblical history. So after all the background is set, we're going to take a step back. We have all the pieces are there. Nimrod, Nebuchadnezzar, Shinar, Eretz Babel, statue, great big gold statue, tower of Babel. Yeshayahu's prophecy reflecting reflecting Nebuchadnezzar's great arrogance. Nimrod, at least as we attribute it to Nimrod, the sense of arrogance and warrior against God, Gibor Tzad Lifnei Hashem. All those pieces of that puzzle, and of course it ends with the fiery furnace into which Abraham is thrown, according to the Medrash, and Hanani, Mishael, Azariah in the story. So we'll have to come back to that. We're going to jump to Bereshit Perek Yud Aleph. And I've given you the text here, Vayhi kol ha'aretz safa achat u'dvarim achadim. Actually, let's do this in a Gdolot. Let's do it here in Sefer Breshit. Vayhi kol ha'aretz safa achat u'dvarim achadim. Now, what that means is somewhat open to interpretation, but the entire world was of one language, tongue. We discussed this just a week or two ago. What is the significance of a language in Tanakh? What do we have by Nebuchadnezzar? That he brought together every Am, Uma, and Lashon, nation and language. Language is a nationality. Language represents nationality. So by saying that Kol Ha'aretz Safa Achat, that all the people were of one language, what are we really saying? That they were all identified as part of one nationality. Now, if you go into Sefer Bereshit, the irony here is that Sefer Bereshit, the whole previous parak, is a description of Eile Toldot Noach and the description of all the different nations of the world that were born from the children of Noach. Me'elu nifridu ye goyim baratzotam ish lilshonol mishpuchotam b'goyehem. In each person born from these nations, if you go back to Bnei Noach, Shem, Cham, and Yafet, and then Yafet, Gomer, Magog, Madai, Yavan, Tuvah, Meshech, Tiras, Ashkenaz, Rifat, etc., Yavan, Tarshish, Kitim, Dodanim, this is generations before the tower. This is generations, this is a generation or two after the flood. And these are the nations from which the land's languages was developed. Lushanola Mishpachotam b'goyehem. And then you have Cush and Mitzrayim. So it's great irony to say that the entire world spoke one language when just one chapter ago, we describe at length every descendant of Noah and how they spread out over the world and how they created different nations. So that's one of the mysteries in the story of the tower. How is it that we describe kol ha'aretz safa achat, of one language, one tongue, udvarim achadim, one dibur, one speech, as if they're all one nation? We just finished saying that they're not. Just a chapter ago described the great dispersion of all the different languages and cultures. And Rashi, on this verse, suggests that that one language was in fact Lashon HaKodesh, was in fact Hebrew, and yet they're speaking all kinds of different languages. So hold that thought. That's a question we have to resolve. Vayhi b'nas'am mikedem. They traveled eastward. Vayimtzu bik'a be'eret Shinar ve'yishvu sham. They found a valley in the land of Shinar. They dwelt there. Vayomru isha le'eyu havanu b'na levenim v'nisufa l'sreifa. Let's bake bricks and turn them into in the furnace. And they'll turn the brick into stone, and then they can use mortar, and they can begin to build. And once they have the technology to build, then, of course, the next step is to build up. A city, a tower, its head in the top in the heavens. I'm not going to do it today because it's not our subject, but I would urge you to consider a parallel between this tower and with its head in the heavens and Jacob's ladder, Virosho Bashamayim, which was in the heavens, or its top was in the heavens. Minaseh lanu shem, let us make a name for ourselves. Pen nafutsa pnei kol ha'aretz, lest we disperse over the earth. V'yered Hashem l'ot et ha'ir v'et ha'migdal asher banu b'nei Adam. God came down to see the tower and the city that the people had built. Vayomer Hashem, en am echad, b'safa achat l'kulam. Behold, they are one people in one language, and this is what they have begun to do. Zeh ilam lasot. Ata lo yibatzer meyam kol hashiyizmu lasot. Therefore, God says, I will prevent this from taking place. Aben yerda v'navla shem sfatam. We will mix up their languages. Asher lo yishmu ish sfat ra'eyu, so they will not understand each other. God disperses them, they stop building the city, and of course our king Kreshma, Bavel, hence the name Bavel, because Bavel, says the Torah, comes from the word Balal, Balal Hashem Sfat Kol Aretz. God mixed up all the languages and scattered them, Misham Hefitzam Hashem Apnei Kol Aretz. And then the rest of it is the continuing the descendants of Shem, through Abraham and Terach. We'll talk about that at the end of the shiur today. That's the story. So there's some basic, obvious questions. First of all, what's so terrible about unity? Right? We all clamor, we dream about a unified people and a unified society. So that's just a basic question. But what is this sefachat, this single language, when they were already identified by nations and geography and language? And what is this tower, and how does stopping this tower address their issue? What is the sin? What was so terrible about building this tower in the first place? Rashi insists that dealing with God intervening against the building of this tower, there must be something theologically problematic, like idolatry here. And so Rashi says, "Ba'o be'etzah achat bi'amru." Famously, Rashi's comment that we'll go up to the heavens and we will conquer the skies. And where does Rashi get this from? That the tower intent of the builders of the tower wanted to run into the heavens and throw God out. But there's no reference to that in the story. Well, it says we'll build a tower, pen nafots, lest we scatter over the earth. We'll make for ourselves a name by building a tower. We live in a world where towers and skyscrapers are the best way to make yourself famous. That's exactly what they wanted to do. So where does Rashi get the idea from that building this tower was a way of going up to the heavens and throwing God out? Well, the answer is I gave you the answer already. Where did Rashi see this idea that the arrogance of the king of Bavel was in the effort to go into the heavens and remove God and sit on God's throne. That's precisely what Yeshayahu ascribes to Nebuchadnezzar, right? That's exactly the proclamation. I will go up into the heavens and sit above the clouds, and I will be the one on high instead of God. So Rashi links the story of Nebuchadnezzar to the story of the tower above it, and attributes to them the same chet. Whether that's true in the pshat of it or not, but that's clearly where Rashi is drawing that idea from. Rashbam is bothered by the fact that there's no reference to the theology of throwing God out of the heavens and building of the tower. So the Rashbam offers a somewhat different interpretation. He says God had commanded humanity to populate, pruervu, to fill the world, miluat haaretz, and they chose instead to gather in one place, not to spread out over the world. That was against God's design of creation. But again, for that, it sounds Rashi's description of the chait of the door of the generation of the tower sounds much more plausible, much more intense. In fact, there's a lengthy Gemara in Sanhedrin that offers various opinions as to what was going on. We'll just take a brief look at it. Dora Palaga en lem chelok la'am haba. Mishnah says that the people who built this tower kind of lost their chelok, share in the world to come. What did they do wrong? So Gemara offers several answers. First answer, debate of Shiloh, nivne migdal v'nale l'rakia v'nake otom b'kardumot k'dei sh'yazuvu mima. They wanted to build, says the Gemara, a tower that would go up into the heavens, so that they can take their axes into the heavens and strike God down and see God bleed. That was the first answer. Gemara has a very kind of satirical response. Machku ala b'marava. They laughed at this explanation in Israel, in the West, because they said, if they wanted to go up to the heavens and throw God out or to stab God with a spear, then they shouldn't have gone into the valley to build the tower. They should have started with a head start. They should have started by building the tower at the top of a mountain. I'm not sure that that's really an answer. But Yirmiyahu ben Elazar says, Nechlaku l'shalosh kitot, with different people there having different intentions. Some said that we'll go up to the heavens and there we will live. Others suggest we'll go up into the heavens and we will worship idolatry, or we will worship other gods. We'll bring our gods with us, so to speak. And one suggested that they will go up into the heavens and will make war with God. To which the Gemara's conclusion is that all of these answers really stem from a perversion of the concept of deity or God. Kulam l'shem avodah zarah nitkavnu. But I come back to the question, what was the intention? What was the pshat of this story? The story is so central. The story of the tower of the flood, we can work through the science of it, but the story of the flood we understand. It's relatively straightforward. The story of the tower is very short. It's very concise. Its impact is far-reaching. And yet there's so much mystery around. We don't even know what the chait was. And yet God directly intervenes. In the generation of the flood, the Torah tells us exactly what the chait was. Vatimaleha aretz chamas. People were killing each other. So God intervened. The tower, what was the issue? So I want to share with you what happened to this floor now. I don't know how that got out of order. I apologize for that. I want to share with you the insight of the Sforno. And I think the Sforno is very important because really amongst all of the commentaries that I have seen, I think the Sforno understood the geopolitical message, context of all of the pieces of the puzzle. Meaning, we're talking about a land of Shinar. If we're talking about a land of Shinar, we're talking about, right, the tower is placed in Eretz Shinar. Eretz Shinar is exactly the region of who? Who is king of Shinar? We'll go back to the Psukim in Migdal Bavel,
Nimrod.
Nimrod. Right? That's exactly. They start. Eretz Shinar is the land of Nimrod. Right? But the Reshit Mamachto Bavel Eretz Akkad, the Kalne Eretz Shinar. So suddenly, within the same context, I have Nimrod, Gibor, warrior, Gibor Tzayid, and I have in Eretz Shinar, and I have a tower in Eretz Shinar that begins with the description of a people, Safachat Udvarim Achadim, building this great tower. Comes along the Sforno, and I apologize for the jumping around. Maybe we'll do it here, be a little less jumping around. Nikol Aret Safar Chatu Torim Machadim. Let's see if this Sforno is here. It's not here. We'll have to go back. I apologize for that. Okay, we'll do it on the slash. I apologize. Says Nimrod. Says this one now. Havani Blenonu Ir. What is this tower, the city? Zot Haita Atzat Sare Hador. What do they intend to do? Lhamich et Nimrod al Hamin. Akol Hamin Ha'enoshi. Intention was not just to build a city, but to build a kingdom. What the Sforno recognized is that a city with a tower, Ir U'Migdal, Migdal is a fortress, and a city with a fortress is essentially a kingdom or a place of a melech. And who is going to stand at the top of that tower? Who is going to stand at the top of that tower and look out at the city that they had built with their hands? Migdal v'doshah b'shamayim v'naseh lanu shem. What does it mean, naseh shem? He says, havadah zarah shetiyeh b'migdal, will put some sort of idol at the top of this tower. V'yetzeh b'chol amin enoshi shem. And she shem gova mekoma, the godel ira, the name of this great, the reputation of this great tower, of this great city, of this great migdal, will go over all, will be recognized by all of humanity. Ba'ofen shetachashev Elohei Elohim etzel kol bnei Adam, everybody will see this deity as towering over everybody else. Pardon the pun. Ve'leh yidrashu kulam. Says this one. והכוונה בזה הייתה שהמלך על אותה העיר ימלוך על כל המין האנושי והיות שם דרישת כולם. Whoever reigns over this city and this tower reigns over all of humanity. Now, what the Sforno is suggesting, I believe, in this story, which I think is the core of the message, is that what they wanted to do is not, let's go back to the text for a second. Kol ha'aretz safa achat u'dvarim achadim. They're all of one language. Why are they of one language and one speech? Not because they all come from one cultural identity, one region, one nation, and therefore speak one language. But I can bring together all kinds of different peoples of different languages and different tongues and give them all one language, one tongue, one speech, and one identity very easily. It's called in the language of Tanakh, it's usually called conquest. It's usually called an empire. In other words, if we're talking about Eretz Shinar, and we're talking about the land of Nimrod, and Nimrod is Gibor Tzayid Lifnei Hashem, as a warrior, and suddenly I go from all kinds of different nations and different regions, speaking different tongues, and Mishpachotahem, and Goyahem, and nationalities, and suddenly they're all one region, one nation, one tongue. That's not a natural development. That's an artificial development. That's a tower and a building that was created to tower over them and to bring them together by force of conquest into being one nation, one peoples, one Safa, one Dvarim. And now you build a tower that literally towers over them, says the Sforno. Who's going to stand at the top of that tower? Who's going to look out and say, this is my kingdom? I am the king over all of these nations and all of these regions, and you will all pay homage and bow to me. Answer. Who's the king of Shinar? Nimrod. That's precisely the story of this tower. It wasn't about theology. It was about politics. It was about placing one king as a king of an empire over the entire world. That is a very dangerous precedent in the language of Tanakh. In the language of Tanakh, there is only one king over the universe, over all of humanity, and that's God. To place a human being as king over all of the other kings and as a global hegemony, global empire, is a theme that Tanakh fights against from the Tower of Babel to Nebuchadnezzar. And every attempt at creating a global hegemony in that context has failed in Tanakh because God intervenes to prevent it from happening. Because if you place all of humanity under one banner, that banner is benevolent, great. And if that banner is Nazism, we're all in trouble. One all-powerful leader has never been an answer that the Torah or that Tanakh has embraced because it's fraught with danger. Here's another example. Daniel, Perek Daled. We're going to get to this next in our next unit. Chapter 4, same Nebuchadnezzar. The context of here is not our issue. It's another moment of Nebuchadnezzar's arrogance. After 12 months, he comes up to the top of his palace. Al-Hichal Malchuta de Bavel Mahalech, he was walking on the top of his tower, on the top of his kingdom, and he looks out and he says the following, and think for a moment what he's saying and whether these words would fit. First of all, the description Yeshayahu describes of Nebuchadnezzar's arrogance with the description of Bavel, Tower, and Nimrod, as the Sforno describes it. What did Nebuchadnezzar say? Ane malka ve'amar, halada hi Bavel rabta. This is the great Bavel. The ana benate I built, levet malchu, with my vast power, bitkaf chisni, likar hadari, and with the glory of my majesty, as a royal residence, levet machut. This is the Bavel. This is my kingdom that I built with my power and the glory of my majesty. Well, in chapter 4, it doesn't take more than 10 seconds for the words to come out of his mouth before God transforms Nebuchadnezzar into a beast of the field for 7 years to teach him a little humility. That story we'll get to. Can you imagine the statement, the arrogance? I could just see Nebuchadnezzar, Nimrod, standing at the top of this tower, looking out of his great kingdom, says the Sforno, and saying, Dahi Bavel Rabta de Ana Benate, this is the great Bavel, or this is the great tower, the Migdal of Shinar, that I built with my power and my strength and my majesty for all of humanity to come and be united under my banner. And God says, not today, not on my watch. And so he enters into history to put a stop to Nimrod's great tower. That, says Sforno, is essentially the story. It's about the politics. And the other Mepharshim would make the same claim. I think Chazal essentially said this, but they do so with other nuances. For example, Nebuchadnezzar put this great statue of gold, 60 amot high, which is a symbol of Nebuchadnezzar's arrogance. Where did he put it? In the valley of Dura, Bebikat Dura. We don't know where Bibi Katura is. It's not told to us in the story. But look what the Malbim says. ומילתו בבקעת דורה, ולדברי חז"ל, היא עצמה הבקעה שנתקבצו בו דור הפלגה לבנות המגדל. Chazal say that this valley where Nebuchadnezzar put his statue is the same valley in which the tower of Babel was built. Now, Chazal didn't say that arbitrarily. They said that because they saw in the statue the exact same arrogance that they saw in the story of the tower. Shaitak of Natam Gamken, Lahakim Lahem Malchut Atsuma Vitkifa Kolelet Nitzchit Mirosh Vyatsov. The tower was also intended to build a kind of eternal, all-encompassing power and malchus. To fight against the heavens. They were the same purpose. The Tower of Babel and the statue of Nebuchadnezzar served exactly the same purpose, to reflect the power of the king and his eternity, and ultimately his fact that he was king not only over his kingdom, but over all the kingdoms, and hence the description in the case of Migdal Babel of Kol Aretz Sefah Achat Udvarim Achadim, because Nebuchadnezzar, Nimrod had in fact conquered them and brought them together artificially as one nation. Not that they were that this was kind of indigenous to a population that spoke one language. But on the contrary, from the separate languages you described in chapter 10, suddenly they're all speaking one language because they're all speaking Nimrod's language. That, says the Sforno, is what the tower represented, Nimrod's power and his might, and ultimately what God, a power that got too strong and too arrogant, and God had to intervene. And in that intervention, and God's providential intervention in the tower, the message goes out that ultimately there's only one king of kings. I shared with you once before the notion that Nebuchadnezzar describes himself as king of kings. So we describe God as king of kings, melech machay amlechim, because there's only one global power in the world, and that's a Kodesh Baruch. The notion of a human king literally establishing global conquest is an anathema to the theme of Tanakh. And that starts in Migdal Babel. And from Migdal Babel to Nebuchadnezzar, that theme is consistent. Literally divide and conquer. Divide the nations in the world into nations. Divide the world into nations. Why? Because divided, we can all recognize that there's one power above us all. But unite humanity into one earthly power, that's very dangerous. That's the geopolitical message of Tanakh. And it starts at Migdal Babel and it ends with Nebuchadnezzar. Okay. So just to put things in context where we are right now, we've explained the tower and the arrogance of Nimrod, and the tower or the statue and the arrogance of Nebuchadnezzar, the intervention of God in the case of the tower, and the intervention of God in the context of the Nebuchadnezzar's statue, and as if to reflect the similar message that ultimately both of these challenge godliness in the world, and therefore God had no choice but to intervene. I want to take us back into a very interesting phenomenon here. Because what I haven't done is one more piece of the puzzle I haven't linked. Because Chazal get to all of this, how? By connecting Hanani, Mishael, Azariah, so the fiery furnace, to Avraham and his furnace. Where is Avraham in the story? Where is Avraham in this story? So there are two points of departure to connect back to Avraham. One is midrashic, and the other is textual. So actually, I'm going to start from the midrashic context. There's a pasuk in chapter 10. Remember, the tower is in the beginning of chapter 11. Beginning of chapter 11. It's a pasuk in chapter 10 that describes a kind of the genealogical generations from Noah to the tower, or essentially, or to Abraham. And there we have a reference to Eber. Famous Shem and Eber, Eber, grandson of Shem, has two sons. One is named Peleg, Ki b'yamav niflaga ha'aretz. In his day was the story of the tower of the dispersion of humanity. And his younger brother, Yoktan, both mentioned in chapter 10. From this verse, the Medrash Seder Olam Rabbah builds the entire chronology of the generations from the flood to the tower, because it attempts to pinpoint exactly when the tower event took place by suggesting it took place at the end of the life of Peleg. Now, we could argue it took place at the beginning of his life. That's why he's named after the tower. Chazal actually say it can't be, because Yoktan, who's his younger brother, is mentioned in the previous chapter. So for that reason, Chazal say it's not at the beginning of Peleg's life, but in fact, the end of Peleg's life. You know, the Medrash and Seder Olam, Medrash says, Amar Rav Yossi, Navi Gadol Haya Ever Shekara Beno Peleg. Ever was a great prophet because he named his son Peleg, Ruach HaKodesh. As it says, B'yamav Niflaga Aretz, Rashi quotes us on the Pasuk as well, that Yoktan is younger and is mentioned in the previous chapter, so clearly doesn't mean the end of his life, can't mean some vague moment in the middle of his life, so it must mean that his death coincided with the Tower of Babel, and he's called Peleg, whether he was called Peleg Beruach HaKodesh, or he's called Peleg at his death, so to speak, because that was coincided with the tower itself. Neither does it may, based on that, the Medrash then pulls together all of the lineage of the generations. Rather than doing it in the text, I'm simply going to show you the chart. And the chart, literally, this is based simply on the psukim I've given you, the sources, on the psukim in chapter 10. From Noah, who's 600 years at the time of the flood, let's assume for the moment the flood is year zero, for all intents and purposes. Arpachshad is born 2 years after the flood, then Shelach when Arpachshad is 35, Eber when Arpachshad, Shelach is 30. This is all in chapter 10 and 11. You can just read the text and you can see the ages. Peleg is 30 when he has Reu is 32 when he has Srug, Srug is 30 when he has Nachor, Nachor is 29 when he has Terach, Terach is 70 when he has Abraham. Peleg lives for 239 years, which means, drumroll, and if I work through the numbers, the exact year of the dispersion of the tower is 340 years after the flood. And according to the chronology, it means that Abraham is 48 years old at the time of the tower above. Process that for a second. Bereshit Rabbah, how old was Abraham when he recognized God? Now, we all know the story. I want to stop sharing for a second because I want us to hear this. We all know the story. If I take any child from the day school and I said to them at the age of a first grader, and I said, how old was Abraham when he first discovered God? They would tell me?
75.
They would tell me he was three, right? They all know the story. He's 3 years old. He asks us who made the stars, who made the moon, who made the bill, right? Who made Abraham's theological journey, searching at the age of three. Comes along the Medrash and says, wait a second, that might be, it's based on a pasuk, but I have a much better answer for you. Ekev Hashem Avram B'Koli, Rabbi Yochanan V'Rabbi Chanina said, Amre ben Arba'im V'Shmona Shana Hikir Avraham et Bor'o. Avram was 48 years old when he recognized God. Rish Lakish says he was 3. I'm less bothered by Rish Lakish's opinion. It's more philosophical than anything else. It doesn't have any textual references. But 48 is a number that sounds like you pulled a number out of a hat. Why is Abraham 48 when he recognized God? Well, now we have the answer. What major event, upheaval in society and global geopolitics that has transformed society to the point of recognizing that he was all of humanity united under one banner? There was no greater power on the planet than Nimrod. And yet Nimrod's efforts failed because somebody or something intervened above Nimrod, above the King of Kings, more powerful than the King of Kings. Who could be more powerful than the King of Kings? Says Avraham at the age of 48, who's a bystander watching this tower crumble and watching the global effort to unite humanity under one warrior banner fail, and comes along and says, God is, there's a God who is controlling this history. It's not a philosophical journey, it's a historical journey. He sees that intervention and he feels that effort. Now, where did Chazal get this from? It's very simple. Here's the story of Migdal Bavel. Here's Perek Yud Aleph. Here's the tower. After the story of the tower in Perek Yud Aleph, we have the following account. Elu toldot Shem, Shem bet me'a shana v'yolad v'pachshad, shnatayim achar ha'mabul. All that chronology that I just shared with you is all in this Perek. The same Perek, just after the flood, tells us the whole story of the generations, Peleg, Aver, who gets Peleg, and he names him after this, after the dispersion, and et cetera, until the birth of Abraham. And Terach is 70 years old when he has Abraham. Abraham, Nachor, and Haran. Ela told the Terach. Terach alidat Abraham. Haran, et cetera. Vayamot Haran afle Terach Aviv. Haran dies. That's the verse upon which the Medrash in Bereishit Rabbah tells us the whole story of the fiery furnace. Nimrod, God, Abraham comes before Nimrod because he serves God, and Nimrod wants to throw him into the fiery furnace. Says the Medrash, that's the story of the Kivshanesh. That's the story of Nebuchadnezzar. That's Abraham against Nimrod is exactly Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah against Nebuchadnezzar. Here is the Jew who says there's a God that's more powerful than Nimrod, who stands up and defends God, and who believes and who discovers God. And the story of Abraham and my family's migration to Canaan starts here. Vayikach Terach et Abraham beno, etc. And they begin to the journey to the land of Canaan. Lech lecha starts in the next parasha. Vayom Hashem al Abraham lech lecha. And all the Mepharshim ask the question, why does God suddenly appear to Abraham? When suddenly out of nowhere he comes to Abraham and he says, I choose you? But the optical illusion is we start the story of Abraham from Parshat Lech Lecha. The story of Abraham doesn't start in Parshat Lech Lecha. It starts in Parshat Noach. It starts in the aftermath of the tower. Abraham emerges from the ashes of the tower. That's the story of Abraham. And that's what Chazal wanted us to see in linking Nechananya, Mishael, and Azariah and their stance against the arrogance, the theological arrogance of Nebuchadnezzar. It tells me, go back to the story of Nebuchadnezzar's predecessor, and the context of the arrogance of Babel, the empire of Babel, begins in the tower, and suddenly you recognize and you see the milieu from which Abraham emerges. That's the context of that medrash. So I often, when I shared this whole story, I often get asked the question, so was Abraham thrown into the furnace or wasn't he? I don't know. Probably not. You'll forgive me. But it doesn't matter. Because Chazal weren't trying to tell me that he was thrown into the furnace. Chazal were trying to tell me the Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah's experience by Nimrod essentially teaches me where Abraham's story begins and where Abraham comes from. He comes from, Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah's experience with Nebuchadnezzar teaches me what Abraham's experience in the Bavel experience of the tower and the world in which he emerges. That's the context of that medrash and how it links to Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah. We're going to stop here. I thank you for the extra 2 minutes. Where we're going to go next, which is in 2 weeks' time, because there's no class next week, is the one piece of the story we have yet to come back to. So we kind of went into a digression, I should say, from the world of Abraham. But where we're going to, now we need to come back to the question of what is the statue of Nebuchadnezzar and why Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah didn't bow down to it, and whether they were right or maybe they were wrong. Were they right to allow themselves to their lives to be threatened by not bowing down to this statue. What was the statue? So all of those pieces we will explore B'sof Hashem next week. This background to understand the tower will help us understand the statue, what it represented, what it was physically, what it looked like even possibly, and thereby enable us to understand Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah's experience much better. So that's the background. I thank you for listening to me for close to an hour. I will be happy to stay on for a few more minutes and answer some of the questions in the chat. We've officially ended the class, so I will thank you for sharing and for coming and for joining us.
Thank you. Rabbi, thank you very much. Excellent, excellent class.
Chag Sameach.
Chag Sameach to you all.
Such a masterful teacher you are. My gosh, you inspire us all. I wrote it in the chat, but I'll just say, you know, your passion for it is infectious. You just make it absolutely fascinating.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
Can I ask a communal question? Another member asked it as well. The difference between the two words for language, between Safa and Lashon.
Yeah, if I was the Malbim, I would probably delve into a whole analysis of the difference and nuance between them. I tend not to get overly excited about that. I'm not convinced that they do mean anything significantly different. I think they are synonymous. In the same way that in Megillat Esther, you have Ktav and Lashon. I think they're somewhat synonymous with each other.
Yeah. Oh, thank you.
Okay. Any other questions?
I just told you. Okay.
Yeah, I'm not sure. Let me just see if there's anything in the chat.
So at 5, I started having meetings.
Oh, so the question of somebody asked a question of the chronology by Abraham. That's an interesting question altogether. Abraham's journey, if it starts at the age of 48, until you get to a nevuah, according to some suggestions, the earliest nevuah he has is the Brit Ben HaPtarim at the age of 70, but that's going to take time to develop that relationship. It's not going to happen overnight. All right, we could go into his whole second hour shiur on the connection to Chanukah, but I'll leave that for your imagination to go from Nimrod to Nebuchadnezzar to Antiochus Epiphanes. Not a big jump, very easy to kind of make that connection and see the story of Chanukah in there. So that's your Chanukah connection, and I'm going to say at least a Chanukah reference on shiur that takes place on Chanukah. Have a wonderful evening, or a wonderful afternoon, or a wonderful morning. Enjoy all over the world. Thank you for listening. Thank you for sharing.
Thank you. Chag Sameach.
Chag Sameach.